cue Bill Doggett. Sunday night at 7 p.m., and that means that from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen, John Mack, welcoming you to the 145th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recording for the previous 144 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com. That's J-O-H-N-M-A-C in John Mack. www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. My most recent piece for the Westchester Guardian is at website www.westchesterguardian.com. The Westchester Guardian is westchesterguardian.com. It includes the 204th column, the Creative Disruption Series. I hope you'll read the column and, if desired, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. That my web home that I gave before, www.johnmack13.com, you'll also find links to the previous radio shows and to my online daily newspaper. The newspaper is a curation of news articles from around the country and the world, articles relating to politics, sports, books, the environment, arts, entertainment, opinion, and technology, with the real focus on artificial intelligence, machine learning, big data, and what lies ahead. But I hope you'll join us every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings for live, or as most do, to listen later. And on to this show, the 145th in the series, as I mentioned. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. But I usually hold callers until near the end of my interviews with my guests. However, if some call in with particular knowledge of the time or place, I'll bring them in when we get to that subject. My guest tonight is Joe Crane Messina, technologist, musician, blogger, and radio host. But I first met Joe and his wife, Nicole, through their then 6.5-year-old son, Thurston, who constantly dismays the members of the so-called Barnes & Noble All-Stars at the Mohegan Lake Bookstore with his knowledge and interest. I know that Joe has just this week begun a new position with IBM, and I thank him for giving me the time while his mind is swimming with his new duties and challenges. Good evening, and welcome to the show, Joe.
Good evening. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Okay, let's go back to the beginning. Where'd you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up out on Long Island, primarily in Suffolk County, mostly in the Patchogue-Medford area, which is where I also spent my grade school years.
Then how early did you get into music?
I I guess the real start was when I turned 15, was when I got my first guitar and then started to take it seriously.
What happened after grammar school? Did you go
well,
to high school?
So when I was younger, living out on Long Island, my grandmother, who worked for the IRS, she had a two-week vacation in the summer. And every year, all of us would go up to Lake George. And when I say all of us, I mean my mom, myself, my aunt and her four kids, my grandmother, and maybe a few other people. And one year, when I was about 12, I think, we decided that we'd rather just stay up there. And so my grandmother bought a big house, and we all moved into it. And so I spent my high school years up that way. Actually, not all the way up to Lake George. We ended up settling just west of Saratoga in a little town called Galway. And it's funny to use the word settling like we were some pioneers or something. But, yeah, that's where we ended up.
That Saratoga Lake is just a gorgeous lake. I was up there for the funeral and the burial at a new VA cemetery, fairly new Saratoga Lake, and I was extremely impressed with Saratoga.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah, I love it up there. I haven't spent too much time up there over the last few years, but yeah, it's a lovely area.
So once you got into your guitar, were you in the band? Did you form the band or what were you playing?
Well, yeah, it's kind of an interesting story. I'll try to not go on too long about this, but when I was 14, I was friends with one fella who was just like a year older than me. And through him, I actually realized that I had more in common with his younger brother, who was a year younger than me. And we started to become really close. And we had decided that we were going to both get guitars and learn how to play guitar together. And before we actually, I had ordered my guitar, I think like through the Sears catalog. My first guitar was a Harmony. And this was about 88, so early 88. The unfortunate thing happened. We were in a really bad car accident, and me and both my friend were in this accident, and I was hurt really badly, but he actually passed away and as a result of the accident. And so that was a really, you know, devastating incident. I spent several weeks in the hospital. And I actually turned 15 in the hospital, and the guitar that I had ordered arrived while I was still in the hospital. So that's kind of the start of my musical journey. It's a little, you know, sad, but it actually drove me a lot when I was younger. I thought about my friend John a lot, and I felt like I was kind of learning guitar for both of us, and just really thought about him a lot as in the beginning years. And from there, I did start to play with a couple of people in our little town of Galway, but it was usually just kind of learning songs together and, you know, playing solos while the other one would do the rhythm. But about when I was, I guess, 15 or early 16, I started to work at the Saratoga Performing Arts Center, SPAC. And there I met a guy who, similar aged, you know, 15, 16, who also played guitar, and another guy who played drums. And that's when we started to form more of a band. It ended up being a metal kind of cover band with some originals. But we practiced a lot you know, had a really good time with it.
Were you self-taught on the guitar?
I took lessons, but not, they weren't like really serious lessons. I mean, I think maybe it was a mix, you know, the guy was teaching me chords and teaching me some theory and some scales and modes and things like that. But that was like half of it. And the other half was like, okay, what Metallica song do you want me to teach you how to play? So it was kind of half and half. I did try to start taking classical guitar lessons because in the, you know, mid to late 80s, there was something of a, there were a lot of guitar players that were classically influenced in their shredding, if you will. And so I kind of wanted to learn more of that. And I didn't last very long because it was a big focus on reading music and studying music and theory. And at that point I was already kind of just wanting to play, you know, metal songs and kind of get on with it. So I didn't last too long with the more serious, study. And I think even shortly after that, I stopped taking lessons altogether and just kind of learned from playing with other people and took it from there.
Now, did this band that you put together wind up playing at dances and clubs and professionally?
Well, we had one show booked, and our guitar player ended up going to Florida for some reason. And then I can't remember what exactly happened, but he ended up not coming back in time for the show. So we didn't end up playing that one show that we had booked. But we did decide, me and this guitar player and the drummer that we're playing with, got an idea that we wanted to, and this sounds really silly, but we wanted to move to Boise, Idaho together to start a band. And we talked one of my other friends back in Galway to come with us, and he would be our bass player. And then a gentleman who was kind of living with me on and off in my last years of high school to come with us and be our singer. And so that's kind of a whole nother interesting story, but we ended up moving out there and I ended up playing in a band with that guy, Josh from Saratoga. And yeah, there are kind of a few funny stories around that, but that once I got to Boise, I started to play much more seriously in terms of rehearsing and playing shows and recording music and going on tours and things like that.
So what was the attraction in Boise? You normally hear people going to Nashville or to New York City or to LA. Why
yeah,
Boise?
Yeah. The my friend Josh, the guitar player from Saratoga, his brother was going to school at Boise State University. And you know, we were 16-year-old kids, maybe 17 at this point. I'm not sure if we were yet, but right around that time. And he went out to visit him and he came back and said, "Joe, it was amazing out there. It was sunny all the time and the women are beautiful and it's just such a great town and the mountains." And I didn't have a lot of plans for after high school. So when he proposed it, I was like, yeah, that sounds like fun, you know? So I really kind of just went along for the ride. But I will say that I'm happy that I did, as silly as it sounds, to move to Boise to start a metal band, because Boise ended up being an amazing city, really, really great music community. I made a lot of great friends. I lived there about 3.5 years, and I really loved it. You know, Boise is a special place for me.
Now on your music websites, and I understand professionally, you've been known as Joe Seppi, S-E-P-I, rather than Messina or Crane Messina. Where did that come from?
Yeah, that started when I got to Boise, or shortly after arriving at Boise, in Boise. I was playing in some bands, and there was like a band house that everybody that lived in this house was in at least one band, and most of them rehearsed in the basement, including bands that didn't even have people living in the house. So this was like the band house. It was called the Vermont House. And one of the guys from one of the other bands who I was close with called me that one day, and he kept calling me that, and it sort of started to take hold. And then when we recorded our first cassette, we were putting names in the in the inside of the cassette cover, and people were like choosing their last name or like their nickname or something, and I was like, oh, I guess I'll use Seppi. I'll go with Seppi, and that kind of like really cemented it. And then from then on, everybody knew me as Giuseppe, from then on. And, you know, it started in music, but as I moved into a career in technology, it came right along with me. And, to this day, I would say probably 3/4 of the people that I know socially think that Seppi is my last name. So it's really, it started in 1991 or 92, and it's lasted this long.
Now, you mentioned this band, and you also mentioned you did some recordings. Do you have recordings out under your name, under the name of the band, or under other names?
Yeah, I have a few recordings out, several perhaps even. I have some under the name Giuseppe, although some of them are under Joe space Seppi, and then some of them are under, if you put the words together, just Giuseppe. So I have, I think, 5 records out under those 2 variations. And I have, in terms of being on Spotify and Amazon and iTunes, I have like maybe 3 other bands that have, you know, 1 or more records on those mediums. And then I have some that are out of print now, like the cassettes that I made with that band in Boise, and some recordings that I did with another band in Olympia. So yeah, I have a few things out there.
Now, you moved around from band to band, and at one point I believe you eventually wound up in Chicago. How'd you get there, and what was your band career like up until then?
Sure. So when I was in Boise, I had a band called Big Mud Wagon, which our singer at the time saw a little postcard that said Big Mud Wagon, an Idaho BMW, and so we kind of stuck with that. And then I played bass in another band called Grant Avenue. And I was there for a few years. And when I was younger, I tended to be sort of impulsive and spontaneous, and things kind of I did things sometimes without very much reason. And one day I just decided I was going to move up to Olympia, Washington. And so I had been in Boise, Idaho for 3.5 years, and then moved to Olympia and played in 2 bands in Olympia, and then also started my like solo recordings when I was in Olympia. And I was there for about 2.5 years, 3 years maybe. The gentleman that I played guitar with in the main band in Olympia, he was from Chicago, from Glen Ellen, actually. And so we played together there, and I decided to move back east and ended up living in Vermont, and he ended up moving back to Chicago. And while we played together in Olympia, it was amazing. It seemed like every other weekend he had friends from Chicago visiting him. And so, like, I knew dozens of people from Chicago already, and some of them actually lived in Olympia. So when I was in Vermont, I was kind of getting bored. I was playing drums in a band out there, and I was in Bennington, Vermont, so it was a pretty small town, and when I was talking to him on the phone saying how bored I was, he said, oh, I'm moving back to Chicago. I'm going to play with a couple of my old friends, and you should come out and we should start another band together. And once again, I was like, oh, that sounds like fun. Sure, I'll come do that. And so that brought me out to Chicago. And there we had kind of a main band that evolved. So it started out as one band. I actually ended up sort of steering us in a direction of kicking out our drummer, which I sort of regret because I love the guy and I feel bad about it, although we're still really close. And when we did that, we changed the band name, but it was, you know, three of the four same people. And then I had another like side project and was doing, you know, solo work there as well.
Initially, and you mentioned when you first got into a band that you have the singer and the drummer and you played guitar. Now, at some point you went in to sing yourself, and you also mentioned playing the drums. What got you into these directions?
Yeah, it's funny that you ask. When I played in the band in Boise, Big Mud Wagon, we kept finding ourselves not happy with our singer for one reason or another. There was like always some reason. We ended up finding a guy that we really liked, but it was right as I was kind of getting the itch to move. But I think because of changing singers so often in those bands, I started to think more about like, you know, what if I were the singer and played guitar, and then I didn't have to worry about, you know, finding another singer every 6 months to a year. So I started to play guitar and sing and try to, you know, get that figured out in terms of like being able to play guitar and sing at the same time and make those two parts of my brain work simultaneously. And I found myself enjoying it, even though I don't think that I'm a very good singer. I enjoy it, and you know, I sing in my style and have fun with it.
I've been listening to music longer than you've been alive, and over the years, There's been very few people that as soon as you hear them on a guitar, you know who it is. Now, there haven't been very many. There's been Les Paul, who obviously started a lot of the modern guitar thing. There's been Chuck Berry. There's been Chet Atkins. How would you – is your playing in any particular style? Is it distinctive? How would you relate it to other – table that I might know?
I would say that one of the people that has influenced me a lot is Dave Davies from the Kinks.
Okay.
You know, Ray's brother. I always liked his sort of manic explosions of guitar solos, and I'm thinking primarily of the earlier years, you know, like you Really Got Me and All Day and All the Night. You know, his guitar solos just kind of bust right in and are exciting and a little manic, and I think I pull from that that well. I also feel fortunate that for a very formative time of my guitar playing in terms of like in a band setting, was when I was in Boise, and the two people that I would say like were my two favorite guitar players were also two of my good friends. One of them is, his name is Brett Netson, and he played in a band called Caustic Resin. But he also was in a band called Built to Spill, which was led by a guy named Doug Marsh. And they played together for many years. They still play together, and they're two of my favorite guitar players, and I think that I take a lot of cues from them as well. And I've always felt fortunate that like two of my favorite guitar players are also two of my good friends. So I'm not sure if you know the name Built to Spill. They're on Warner Brothers Records, and they do really well with the kids.
I do know the name.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. And it was while you were in Chicago that you got into technology, as I understand. How did that happen?
So as I was mentioning earlier, there we had a drummer that was in our band, and he was the gentleman that I sort of forced out of the band, amicably, of I might add. But we were actually really good friends, and my issue with him in the band particularly was that he had gotten a really good job and was focused more on his career, and the other three gentlemen, the other two gentlemen and myself, were still interested in going on tour and, you know, living kind of the band lifestyle. And so I sort of kept pushing us in that direction, which sort of pushed Joel out of the band. But we were really close friends, and he was also a very sweet person, very generous, and his father, this was before he had gotten the good job, said, you know, look, son, you got to kind of buckle down and figure out a career path here. You know, the band thing is fun, but, you know, you got to start paying the bills and get serious. And so this was the very late 90s, and he decided he was going to take COBOL classes to prepare for the Y2K problem. And in his generosity, he said to me, hey, look, if you want to do this too, I think this is really interesting. And you know, it's something we need to be prepared for. And if you learn it, you'll certainly be able to transition into another technology after the Y2K issue and kind of start a career. And I said, you know, I think I'm going to pass. And because I found like COBOL and the Y2K problem like didn't interest me at all. But what ended up happening was he went through the program and got a really good job at Discover Financial, and they gave him a laptop. He brought it home. We were all living together in the band house in Chicago, and I was like, huh, what's this whole internet thing about? And this was 1998, which, you know, had been going on for a while, of course, at that point, but I didn't have an email address. I didn't really, you know, look up websites or anything at that time. But when I had that laptop in the house and started to fool around with it and realized, oh, you know, I can book our band better if I have an email address, and started to look more at websites, I was really curious about how all of it worked. And fortunately for me, I don't know if I stumbled across it or if somebody pointed it out, but you could view the source of the web page that you're looking at. And when I saw the HTML, it made sense to me. I was like, oh, this isn't too complicated. I can read this. I understand what's going on here. And from there, I took some classes, and that's kind of where it where it all started.
I know that you've had quite a career path in technology, and I want to get to it in a minute. Has the music career always accompanied it, or has it been on the back burner at times?
It has largely accompanied it, and been very much alongside of it. I will say that when my wife and I moved from Chicago back east, back to New York, it was backburnered for some time. You know, it took a little bit of time to get settled into New York. It actually took a couple of years. And you know, we had the birth of our child, and I had changed jobs a few times. We were just really, it took us a few years to kind of settle into the New York area. And during that time, music was largely on the back burner, but it started to kind of creep back into my, you know, planning and thought process. But unfortunately, I was having trouble finding people to play with. So I spent a good year or two trying to figure out, you know, do I play with people in New York City? And we had moved up to Peekskill, and it's a lovely city with lots of music going on, but I wasn't finding, you know, other punk rockers to make, you know, loud noises with, which I eventually figured out. But yeah, for a time there, with our settling into New York and having trouble finding people to play, it was certainly backburnered for a bit.
Let's stay with the technology. What was your first professional job then in technology?
Well, my first professional job was it was at a really crazy place called Cherry One Web Design. I'm pretty convinced it was a front for some sort of mafia business. It was really, really insane. And it was a very short 6 months. And I had just met my who is now my wife, Nicole, and she was, when I would tell her all the crazy things that were happening, she would tell me how I really need to get out of there. And funny enough, when I went in to quit, they actually fired me. I don't know if they realized I was coming in to quit and they wanted to, you know, pull the trigger first, but I was like, okay, sure. Okay, I'll see you later. But it was really crazy.
And was that in Chicago?
Yes, that was in Chicago. It was interesting. I was doing, like I had mentioned, I had taken some classes, and funny thing, it was like set up, it was broken into like four parts, this series of classes. I can't remember if it was like 26 weeks or something. The school, I was doing so well in the classes that the school actually asked me to teach the last section of classes that I had paid to attend. And from there, I started like working with some of the other instructors and some of the students I had gone through classes with, doing like freelance projects. And, you know, I was using it to kind of, I was working in restaurants still and playing in bands, and I would just, it would sort of be supplemental that I would do these freelance things. But one day when I decided I didn't want to work in restaurants anymore, I saw a listing in Craigslist for this web design company, and I don't know why, but I just didn't realize that it was like a job that I can go get, that there were agencies that had multiple web designers and developers, and you know, they would pay me a decent wage to come in there and build websites all day. So I was super excited to start there, but I quickly realized that they essentially had a sales team that would get half the money up front for these like mom and pop websites, and they didn't care if they ever got finished. They got their half up front and they just moved on to the next thing. And all of the engineers had like 12 projects, literally 10 to 12 projects that they were all trying to complete. And every one of these clients and customers were super mad because, you know, it was way past the time that they were promised, and you know, it was just a total disaster.
And then where'd you go?
From there, I started working at a small agency called Origin Media. There were three or four of us, and I was doing, you know, similar stuff, small kind of clients. I remember our main client was a retirement community. And so it was pretty mellow, and it was, I mean, compared to the last place, which we literally moved to three different offices in the 6 months I was there, the police were in the office regularly. Our checks were bouncing. Everybody was like, you know, quitting, and it was just total insanity to go from that to this small agency, where everything was really mellow. And we had these clients that were already, we had a relationship with, and we just kind of took our time, and it was like total opposite. So that was kind of actually a really nice change of pace.
Then what got you to New York?
A couple of sort of like life things happened. You know, my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, we were like figuring out some other job related stuff. And I actually always felt like at some point I was going to move back to New York. I missed the mountains, the old mountains. Like I had lived on the, you know, in Boise and in the Pacific Northwest, and I love those mountains, but like I missed kind of the old mountains of the East Coast and the rivers and just kind of the New York City area. And so I always felt like even when I was in Boise and Olympia that at some point I would move back to the East Coast. And technically I did when I was living in Vermont, but like I still went back to Chicago and still always had that feeling like at some point I was going to settle back into primarily I was imagining the Hudson Valley area. And then so these series of events happened where Nicole and I were like, well, what should we do? Should we move to the West Coast or move back east? What should we do? And since we were both from New York, we decided to come back here, and that's how we ended up back in New York.
And did you come with a job, or did you come prepared to look for a job?
Well, excuse me. When I came back, in Chicago, I was working for Sears, and I decided to move back. I was consulting there, and I convinced them to let me work remotely, continuing on the project that we had been building for several months. But I knew, and I think they knew too, that it was, you know, only for a limited time, that everybody else was on the team was in the office, and that, you know, it probably was more of a transition. It helped them in that, you know, I was a valuable team member. I was the team lead at the time. And so it was sort of mutually beneficial to do it for at least some amount of time. So, you know, once I got to New York, within a few weeks, I was already starting to look for roles in the city.
And what were your first positions in New York? Do you remember?
Yeah. So this was in 2008. I found a job as a front-end engineer with a company called Pronto. And it was actually, I shouldn't call it a company, it was a product that IAC Interactive Corp was like kind of one of their, what did they call those? I can't remember the name that they used, but, you know, basically one of these new ideas that they were trying out. And it was essentially a shopping aggregation website that it would crawl all these other websites, all these other shopping websites. And when I got there, it was everything. You know, it was clothing, it was electronics, shoes, you know, home goods. And so it was basically one place to just shop. They would show you the best price, and then when you clicked on it, it would take you to the website, excuse me, that was actually selling the product. So it was interesting to work for IAC. I'm not sure if are you familiar with the company, IAC Interactive Corp?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I am.
They own, you know, Vimeo and Ask.com. I think they sold off Ask. But Vimeo, College Humor, I don't know if they sold off Match too, but a lot of these kind of big name websites. And I'm trying to remember the guy's name who runs it. He's a very well-known name, especially in the New York City media space. And his wife is Diane von Furstenberg.
Okay.
So they're kind of a big deal. And they have this amazing building that looks like an iceberg or an ice cream cake. It's like right at 18th and the West Side Highway. Is it 18th? Yeah, I think it's 18th. Or is it 12th?
Okay.
Anyway, yeah, beautiful building. I remember being on the top floor when Sully landed the plane in the water, and we could, like, I think somebody actually saw it when they were up there, because that was like the cafe area. But, you know, a whole crowd of us were up there watching it float down the river and all of the you know, commotion that was going on with it. But yeah, I worked there for, I think, a couple of years. Basically helped them. They wanted to take this one website that searched for anything and turn it into these verticals for tech products, for fashion, for home goods, and like baby products. They had a few of these verticals that they wanted to have people go through these specific sites rather than this one real general site. And so I built a platform that allowed them to very easily, using the same back-end code and logic, to power these vertical sites for these different industries by basically just leveraging, you know, different HTML paths and CSS styling to basically be able to split off these individual sites.
And then you were also with some other firms. You directed mobile development for a firm. That must have been different than what you had been doing.
Yeah, it's interesting. At that time, you know, mobile was still kind of was sort of emerging. I mean, it was definitely the iPhone was out and things were happening in that space. But I remember being at Pronto and sitting in the CEO's office and saying, like, at the time, our mobile offering, our mobile website and our mobile we didn't have a native app. I'm actually not even sure. Were native apps around then? I can't remember. But our mobile website was a third-party website, and it was, built somewhere else. I don't remember where exactly. And it was beyond substandard. It was really a terrible experience. And I remember sitting down with the CEO and saying, you know, when I go into a store to shop, like, I pull out my phone and I compare prices. I'll get on Amazon, I'll Google it, and I'll see, is this a good price? Should I buy it here? Should I buy it online? And I was baffled why we didn't take mobile more seriously. And he, I don't remember what exactly he said, but it was something along the lines of, oh, that's kind of a fad. I don't think we have to worry about that. And I was just like baffled. And I think that was like the beginning of the end for me there, just realizing that it wasn't a place that I should really take seriously. And they are no longer around. From there, I went to work. Is this accurate? Yes, I went to work at a place called SchedgeMe, which is a terrible name, but was a like scheduling and calendaring application. That's a really good example is a salon that has seats and also stylists. It was a scheduling app that allowed them to pair up their resources with their people, in a intuitive way that helped them manage their business. It was a very small company, and basically, when we started talking about the mobile implementation of the application, the CTO said, "Oh, who wants to lead this?" And it was basically the company, from a technology standpoint, was the CTO who didn't do very much, with the technology, sort of overseen everything and helped make decisions, but didn't do too much on the ground. So it was basically me and another front end engineer and a back end engineer, and I had a little bit of mobile experience. So I said, "Oh, I'll take it on." And so I ended up leading the effort, and we brought on a consulting team from Atlanta to help us to build the mobile application, and I kind of managed that and oversaw it and did some of the development as well as continuing to do work on the web application to the website.
Then you went to Wall Street, to the firm that I have some familiarity with, Credit Suisse. They acquired the firm that we used to consult with, First Boston, which was a brokerage firm. How'd you get there? What did you wind up doing there?
I realized that SchedgeMe wasn't a place that I wanted to be long term, and so I started to kind of shop around. And I remember being in a position where I was considering a position at Hearst, the publishing company, and Credit Suisse. And you know, everybody had told me, like, if you want to make some more money, you should go into finance. And so I got this offer to work at Credit Suisse, but it was a consulting gig, and it was corp to corp. So what that ended up meaning was Credit Suisse would pay this company that had recruited me, and then this company would then pay a company that I had set up, a corporation that I had set up, and then I would pay myself. And the whole scenario just sounded too complicated, and I was just – I had gotten after Sears, like, comfortable with just having a job and, you know, not having to deal with consulting and all the things that kind of go along with that. So I wasn't too interested in another consulting gig. And so they made me an offer, and I think it would have been a little bit more money than the gig at Hearst, but I was leaning more towards Hearst, so I said no. And then they came back and had kind of significantly increased the money that they were offering me. And I was like, oh, well, I guess I'll try that. I'll go for it. It was sort of an offer that you can't refuse. But it turned out to be a little bit of a crazy situation. I guess I find myself in these things regularly. But it ended up working out all right.
During the time you were there, you also started a developers group, HYCHTML5. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So was it around that time? So what had happened when I started at Credit Suisse, I was basically hired as one person, one consultant that was, they expected me to convert this, and I'm off on a slight tangent, but it'll circle around, to take this Java application that they had been working on for 10 years, that was very stable and mature, that did real-time analytics and modeling on this financial data. They wanted me as one person to convert that to a web app, essentially, and it was really like Google spreadsheets or Excel spreadsheets for the web, but times 1,000. And I remember getting in there and like talking to them about what we're gonna do, and like my manager sitting down with me in my cube and saying, "Okay, let's get to work. Let's figure this out." And I was just thinking to myself, "This is, we need a team of like 50 people to do this. This is crazy." It was just baffling to me that they hired me, one person, to do this immense job. And so we kind of started going down that path, and I think it quickly became clear to my manager that this was a much bigger undertaking. And so we brought in a consulting firm called Lab 49. They do a lot of financial work. And they brought in like 20 people who, you know, they were fully agile. They had all of their methodologies in place. They brought in, you know, product manager, project manager, a scrum master, front-end people, back-end people, Silverlight people. So they brought in like a full team. And I remember when they came in, I was like, to my manager, I'm like, I'm going to go sit with those guys and kind of absorb myself into their team and work with them to help figure this out. And so that ended up being a really welcome addition. And, you know, we were able to actually deliver on what they were expecting. So that worked out great. But my connection here is that one of the people in that team from Lab 49 started this meetup group with another gentleman. And at the time, it was called NYC Web App Developers Group, something really long and kind of verbose. But they had done a couple of meetups, I think two or three, and quickly got more busy in their day jobs and weren't able to continue it. And I think actually at this point, I had already moved on to the New York Times, but I don't think it was too far into my time there that the gentleman that I knew there that had started the meetup group reached out to me and said, "Hey, you know, I know you're interested in this stuff. Me and my partner aren't going to be able to continue the meetup group, so you should take it over." And the funny thing is, when I went to go and click the button to assume control of the group, another guy, it was sort of, I don't know how meetup exactly works in this regard, but another engineer had just pushed the button and taken over the group. And like, I reached out to him and was like, "Oh, hey, I know these guys. And you know, they suggested I take over the group." And he's like, "Oh yeah, I know them too. And I got big ideas. So, you know, why don't you come along?" And I was like, "Oh, okay." And I actually asked around to a couple of people that I know, and they knew him too. And they're like, "Yeah, he's a good guy." And so another gentleman from the New York Times and myself joined forces with him. And that's where NYC HTML5 started.
What did you do at the Times?
I was a software engineer there as well. I throughout my development career, I primarily focused on the client side, on browser development, particularly JavaScript. So at the New York Times, I ended up in a couple of different groups. The first one was the video replatform, and then I went to the e-commerce team, and then I ended up being on the team that did the redesign and replatform. That happened, I guess, maybe a couple of years ago now, but it was sort of a big deal when it was all launched. I helped kind of figure out the foundational aspects of that replatforming, and then once we got that figured out, I was helping building out some of the features.
So I was the Times subscriber for years, and first it was free, then they went on a cost basis, then they went back to free, and then finally they went back to a cost basis. Do you know why they gave up the cost basis the first time? Do you have any idea?
I don't. I don't have any backstory on that.
And then after being with them, you went with your most recent job with the firm that I imagine was an independent that Adobe bought, or was it always a subsidiary of Adobe? How did that work?
Yeah, you're referring to Behance, which was acquired by Adobe a little over 3 years ago. I did work at a fintech firm for about six to eight months in between the New York Times and Adobe, which was interesting. But with that short time period, I realized that it wasn't a great place that I wanted to spend a lot of time, and so I did end up moving over to Behance. They had already been purchased when I got there. They were maybe like 2 years into the acquisition. But they really maintained their identity within this larger company, and they still do. It's kind of interesting how they've been able to carve out their space in this larger corporation. So yes, they're very much an Adobe part of Adobe, but managed to still kind of function as quote unquote Behance.
Now you also during that time you went out and you talked to groups, you developed relationships with various groups, you organized various outreaches. Is this the first time that you had done much of this?
No. Throughout my career, I've always gravitated towards what I term developer relations or developer advocacy. It sort of started back at Sears. We just had a really strong technical team, and we were very happy to share with each other, and we did a lot of pair programming, and we all sat around two great big tables, and so we just talked a lot and did a lot of just, you know, general knowledge sharing in whatever format. And ever since then, like, I had been looking for a place like that, and I think in not finding exactly what I was looking for, I either would try to recreate it or go outside of the company and, you know, as a part of the meetup group or just in general be a part of the community. So everywhere that I've worked, I've done some sort of flavor of developer relations, if you will. And at the New York Times, I was actually working with the CTO to kind of formalize that role for me because I had done a number of things at the Times. I started a weekly JavaScript internal meetup that was very successful. Everybody I would get thank you notes like on a very regular basis. And it was a really fun group, and I had a great pool of really smart people within the Times to gather up each week. But also I occasionally brought in outside speakers as well, and it was very well received. And so through my efforts there internally and as well as externally and working on like the Times Open events, which are public events that the Times tech team puts on, the CTO and I were trying to formalize that role. Unfortunately, there was like a hiring freeze right when we were getting really close to it, and I got this offer from this fintech company, so I ended up leaving. But that's when I started to, you know, at the times I started to do the meetup group and just engage more in the community. And interestingly, while I was at Behance and Adobe, we also tried to formalize my role doing developer relations work there. And it started to happen, but then we just sort of started to get too many features that we wanted to build into our products. And so engineering still kind of kept the developer relations work at a distance. But these couple of times trying to form put the role together, it made me start to look more at other companies that did have that role already established. And sure enough, I found the developer evangelist role with the StrongLoop team at IBM.
Jess, that brings us to your current position. What is the StrongLoop team? What does that mean?
StrongLoop is or was a company. They were acquired by IBM 6 months ago. They were started, I think, a few years ago, and they focused on Node.js, which is JavaScript on the server side, and they were very core to Node development itself, like the actual core Node platform. For a long time, four of the eight core contributors to the Node project were StrongLoop people. And so they've been very much integral in that space for a long time. And so IBM has been focusing more on Node.js as well as some other technologies to power mobile applications as well as Internet of Things, IoT. And StrongLoop had a couple of projects. One of them is an open source project called Loopback, which does API generation and management very nicely. And they have a number of tools that kind of surround that with monitoring and process management and things like that. And so they've been in the community for some time, and IBM bought them about 6 months ago.
And what is your role envisioned there? Is it developer evangelism, as you mentioned?
Yes. I am the lead developer evangelist there. We have another evangelist on the team, and another gentleman who recently left. So we are looking, and we have a couple of open roles, so we're looking to grow the team to about four or five evangelists, particularly on this team. But even before I took the role, every time I mentioned this opportunity and what is now my job to friends, they're almost everyone I know is like, oh, I know somebody at IBM that does something similar. I'll introduce you. And so I'm very quickly realizing that there are a number of teams like this, and I've been able to kind of coordinate with a couple of them already. So I'm expecting to be able to not only do the things that we need to do on our team, but to coordinate and collaborate with other teams doing similar work in similar spaces throughout IBM.
Terrific. And good luck with it.
Thank you.
This brings us back to your music. Tell us about the least best beast.
Yeah, so as I was mentioning earlier, I was having trouble finding musicians in the New York City area and the Peekskill area, but I did end up finding my now great friend Patrick Conlon, who is the owner of Speakeasy Tattoo here in Peekskill. And he and I started playing with a guy I was working with from the New York Times, who was really a very talented musician, but was kind of bored. He's really into prog rock, and we were doing, you know, sort of punk rock stuff. And so we were just getting really frustrated that we couldn't find a drummer. And one day when Patrick was complaining about it at the tattoo shop, he had recently hired a couple of new tattoo artists. And one of the people said, hey, I play drums. You know, why don't you let me take a stab at it? And within 5 minutes of playing with this person, we were just – it was a perfect fit, and we kind of took off from there.
And where have you been playing, and are you doing any recording?
We played we primarily play in Peekskill, mostly because the two other folks are tattoo artists and they, you know, work weekends, and so we played some in the city, but it's kind of a big deal for them to cut out early and lose money on their tattoo work and then pack all of our stuff up and head down there. So we've been reserving the New York City shows for, you know, bigger shows and maybe when our friends are coming through town on tour or something like that. So we primarily play at Division Street Guitars, which is right downtown Peekskill. It's actually right across the street from the guitar shop. So, I mean, from the tattoo shop. So when we do play there, we literally just take our guitars and amps across the street, which is great. I love it. We did play up in Beacon last weekend at Quinn's, which was really a fantastic show. So yeah, mostly around Peekskill, but, some in the surrounding areas. And on the recording note, the gentleman that works at the guitar shop who does sound for the shows is an amazing audio engineer who works at Studio G in Brooklyn, which is a fantastic recording studio. And we were scheduled to record with him a month or two ago, and our drummer was sick at the time, and so we ended up canceling it. But we're looking to reschedule it sometime soon.
There's a fellow that I've had on the show, Fred Gillen Jr., who's also from the Peekskill area. He has a recording studio down in, I believe, it's Croton. And I was speaking to his wife this morning outside church, and she mentioned knowing you and Nicole and Thurston.
Yeah,
he's a very interesting fellow.
Yeah, I like Fred. He's a really nice guy.
What made you and Nicole decide to homeschool Thurston? On another topic.
Yeah, that's a good question. We had tried a number of things. He was in a German immersion preschool, and then the German school in White Plains, and we weren't particularly happy with that. Neither Nicole or myself have had really great like public school. Our public schooling hasn't always been great. Mine I didn't realize wasn't great until I went to college. I got like great grades in school and was like on a roll and did pre-calc and calculus and math. But when I got to college, I was shocked at how much I didn't know and realized that maybe my public schooling wasn't so great.
We didn't mention college. Where'd you go to college?
I went to Boise State for a little bit while I was there.
I
didn't go for too long because I was playing in bands and I was living with some hippies and you know, college wasn't kind of gelling with the rest of the things I was doing. So I gave up on it. I only spent, I think, 2 or 3 semesters in school, which I think sometimes I was just going to say surprises people considering my career in technology.
I know that Nicole wasn't happy. She mentioned to me that she was that she wound up changing her desired major in college because she thought that the whole department that she wanted to go into was sexist, that they didn't respect women in the sciences.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, she didn't have she did really well in school and you know, came out all right, but it was, you know, challenging for her for sure.
Well, back to Thurston. So then you went into homeschooling?
Yeah, we even tried a progressive school that was supposed to be really, you know, progressive. And we still just felt like it wasn't the right fit. You know, I think that we have kind of high standards, and we also think that, I mean, we believe that children should be children, you know, in these ages. You know, he's only 7 years old, and he just recently turned 7, and we just want him to be happy and enjoy his childhood and really develop a love for learning. And, you know, we just weren't really finding that with the other options that were out there. And We had the opportunity to be able to homeschool, and now that I'm working with IBM, my position is a remote position, so I can work from home more regularly. So that should help as well. We just, you know, we want these younger ages to be young, innocent, and fun, and we don't want him to spend his time like lining up to go outside and single file and here's all your homework and you have to learn how to do this right now because you're this age. We want to do more child-based learning. We kind of follow maybe more the concept of unschooling where you just sort of let the child's interests guide what you do and work the learning into that. And I think it's working out really well. You know, he loves earth sciences and, we just follow the things that he enjoys and then work in, you know, reading and writing and math into those things. It's not really that hard at this age to kind of follow that sort of a path.
I know just from my limited experience from that he's into hiking, piano lesson, science, Doctor Who, Lego, Minecraft, and other computer activities. He mm-hmm. builds things. He's talked about being interested in, you know, planets and everything. What are some of the other activities other than the ones that I've mentioned?
Well, that's certainly a lot of them. He's interested in all those things, you know, music. I mean, I think you kind of named a lot of them. You know, we're reading like Harry Potter, and he's not there yet, but we're reading to him, and he's really super engaged in it. He loves, you know, like kind of sci-fi fantasy stuff. You know, he loved Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. We spent months and months just listening to the radio programs and everything, and he just eats it up. You know, I may be a little biased. We may be a little bit biased, but we think that he's really bright. But a lot of times when he was in those schooling situations, we didn't see that the school or the teachers were seeing the same things that we were seeing. And I understand, you know, they've got to take care of all the kids. And when you're able to just focus on one, you know, you can really kind of find the potential and work on that and you know, find the weaknesses as well and work on those too. But you just do it in more creative ways. It's been an interesting journey for sure. It's a lot of work and very challenging, but I think the rewards are there.
He's obviously very bright. I know that one of the things that people always bring up when speaking of homeschooling is a concern that the student won't develop the friends as well as the social skills that those in traditional classroom environments do. When you were deciding on this, was this a concern in your decision process?
It's certainly a concern. However, Thurston has been wildly social ever since he was younger. Like he is a major extrovert. Like our concern is not that he's going to be antisocial, which I think is sort of the general concern that you end up with homeschooling and kids aren't socializing as much. Because he's super social. Our challenge is to make sure that we meet those social needs that he has. And it's not like forcing him to be social and not be antisocial. It's he craves the social interactions. And so, you know, we have to regularly meet with other kids and, you know, we're part of some homeschooling groups it's a lot of work again, but we're making sure that we meet those social needs. But I don't think we have anything to worry about. As you know, you've met him and you see him, he just runs right over to you or, you know, kids that he knows or you know, anyone that he might know, he's very happy to go over and engage. And what I love about it is that he is interested in what you have to say. You know, he comes over and says, "How was your day? You know, what are you doing?" And he listens and then he responds and he's very conversational, which I really appreciate.
I knew that he was in groups with other homeschoolers and he has the local friends. The interesting thing is that he certainly plays well with adults. My son was very comfortable around adults all his growing up years. My daughter reached a point that she would much rather be with her friends, and why do I have to do this? And you must be very pleased with the way it's working out so far.
Yeah, he's great with adults. I mean, he loves adults, and he's very, you know, we've ever since he was young, we don't dumb down the conversation for him. We use the words that we would use, and you know, we oftentimes follow them up with, you know, that means this, or kind of in a conversational way work in what it is that we mean if we are using bigger words. And he just, we've treated him like that ever since he was younger. And, you know, now he uses words like facetious, and, you know, I'm just always surprised when he is just so conversational and is able to express himself well. So that's great. And one of the other things I was going to mention too, in talking about him being social, on the way up to that gig last weekend, riding with my bandmates, you know, we were talking about Thurston, because Thurston's like, he's like the mayor of Peekskill in some ways. On Saturdays, we go to the farmer's market, we go to the coffee house, we go to the tattoo shop, we go to the guitar shop, and like almost every place that we walk into, you know, 5 to 10 people go, Thurston, how's it going? You know? And so I was, so my bandmates know him very well too. I joke sometimes that they like Thurston better than they like me. But we were talking about homeschooling, and I said, you know, Thurston has some things that we're still working on in terms of social interactions and, you know, how to behave well in groups of kids and not getting overexcited. And, you know, so I basically said, you know, we're still working on some of the social interaction stuff with him. And my friend, you know, and bandmate Pat, who's even a little bit older than me, is like, I'm still working on social interaction. So I really laughed about that. And it was nice to kind of have that context and perspective and be like, oh yeah, you know what? I'm actually still working on some of that stuff too. So, you know, I think he's doing great, and I feel confident that he's going to be just fine.
He listens very well. There was one day that Nicole and I were talking about something, and I brought out the point that, that the same situation, and I think it had to do with me being attacked by the lunatics in New York City and two cops jumping in and plummeting the guy. And
wow.
I said, if I'd walked by, I would have said that was police brutality. As the person who was attacked, I was very happy to see them, you know, hit him again, you know, one of those deals.
Yeah.
And then we explained to him that there's always, in a situation, there's different ways to look at things. And he listened and he had questions about it. I thought that was very interesting. He was interested in that.
Yeah. He's very observant, and sometimes that puts us in those sorts of situations. So whether someone's different in whatever way, whether they have you know, disabilities of whatever sort, or you know, even if they're like covered in tattoos, or you know, he's just very observant, and that oftentimes prompts interesting conversations to talk about how people are different, and you know, everybody's got a different way of being and a different perspective, and you know, that we have to respect that and kind of you know, find our way in the world.
Speaking of conversations at Barnes and Noble, we have a caller on the line from Barnes and Noble. Good evening, Phyllis.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well.
Hi, Phyllis. How are you? It's great.
Good. How are you?
Good. How's Ray feeling?
Well, he's on a good antibiotic now. He had been on the wrong antibiotic, so he's making better progress now. But
okay.
On Friday, he was in very serious, terrible shape from the wrong antibiotic. So he had a really horrible day. But it got straightened out with a new doctor and a new antibiotic. So I think within a week he's going to be fine.
Okay, great,
Phyllis. Phyllis, I didn't realize that there was anything wrong with him since the last time I saw you. What happened?
Yeah, it was a cold that went into the lungs, and there was noise in the lungs, and he had to have a chest X-ray, and he was just getting worse by the minute. So we found a wonderful Chinese doctor, a woman doctor, who I believe has saved him.
Wow.
Well, you better get him better if he's going to work with Thurston on the Raspberry Pi.
oh, I know.
On the computer.
He feels pretty bad about that, but we'll be there eventually.
Yeah, well, the stuff is still shipping too, so we've got a little bit of time. I just, you know, of course, I want Ray to focus on his health and get well.
You haven't received it yet?
No, we haven't. But everything's shipped. But I think the actual Raspberry Pi is shipping from some mysterious place that they gave us some wide date range as to when it'll actually will receive it.
Do you have anything to ask Joe? What do we add to our conversation, Phyllis?
Not really, but it was interesting, and I thank you for letting me know about it. And hope to see you both soon.
Yeah, that sounds great, Phyllis. Thanks for calling.
Okay, thanks.
We've covered a lot of ground tonight. What else might you like the audience to know about Joseph Sepp Ukraine Messina?
Let's see. So I guess I'll mention that I may have a few things to mention. And we did cover a lot of ground. I guess maybe I just have a lot of ground to me. I'm not sure. But so I'm technically in two bands right now. Least Best Beast is our main vehicle, and that's where we focus on our songwriting and you know, it's primarily all original music, although it's all, you know, kind of loud, and I use the term punk rock loosely, but you know, it's kind of noisy, fun stuff. But we also have another band called Mustard Tiger. And this is myself and the drummer from Least Best Beast, and whose name is Micah Vlad, and also a neighbor of mine, J.D. Gambrell, who has played in a number of bands, most recently kind of outlaw punk country sort of bands, but he's a neighbor and a good friend. He and his wife we share cat sitting duties, and you know, they're good people. I ran into them in the supermarket a few months ago and said, "Hey, I'm looking to put together this kind of band project thing where me and a drummer will improvise, you know, kind of loud punk rocky sort of music, and we'll have a front person," and I use the word front person rather than a singer or a vocalist, because I expect them to like run around and engage the audience and be a little crazy and also improvise singing, but just be kind of a bit of a showman and just really kind of engage the crowd. And I was saying it to them to say, you know, if you know anyone from the city and your other musical experiences, let me know. And so I mentioned it. Jason looked at me and said, "Oh, I think I could do that." And I was like, "Oh, wow." Cause he's a very mild mannered Southern, fella. And I was just really surprised that he said that. And I looked at his wife and she said, "Oh yeah, he could do that. He could definitely do that." And, so yeah, we have this band called Mustard Tiger. It's, our motto is never rehearse, always destroy. And we just book shows and show up and get, you know, silly, but play loud, fun music. And he runs around. He has a wireless setup, so he'll run out into the street, and we stash musical instruments around the club. So he might pull out a part of a drum set or a trumpet or something and do that. And we just have a lot of fun with it. So I thought I would mention that project as well.
Where have you been doing that?
Partially because I love this place. Our only two shows have been at the Guitar Shop, Division Street Guitars. And we sort of adopted the sound guy as a part of our band because he, you know, puts on effects and has fun with it too. But I'm looking to book some shows in the city and do some more shows around the Hudson Valley area. The great thing with this band is we literally never rehearse. We just have to book shows, come up with some crazy ideas for the gig and then just show up. So I've been trying to find some quality shows in the city to bring that down there, because I think people are always a little taken back because it's a little crazy, but they always come out saying, "Wow, that was a lot of fun. It was really interesting."
The website for these two bands, sure.
I do. I'm glad you mentioned that. Least Best Beast has a website that is leastbestbeast.com. And, you know, there are a number of things on there. You can find out about our shows and stuff like that. The Mustard Tiger website is mustardtiger.rocks, and that's R-O-C-K-S. It is basically one page that has a video embedded in it. And I'm glad we brought this up because this video is great. I love it. So since we never rehearse and we don't really have songs, we never expect to actually go into a recording studio. So for the last show, I had met a couple of people actually in Peekskill who do video production, and I asked them to come and do our show. And they said, sure, you know, a couple hundred dollars, we'll come and do it. And they came with like six cameras, three people. They had still camera, stationary cameras, but also, you know, followed us around and you know, moved around the audience. And then they edited it really, really well. So this video is super well done. I almost was like felt bad for, you know, I gave them a little bit extra, but I felt like I should have gave them five times as much money because they did such an amazing job. And they're local in Peekskill. Oh boy, now I can't remember their name. But if anybody is interested, reach out to me and I'll connect you because they're really great people. So that's on the Mustard Tiger website. It's mustardtiger.rocks.
Do you know what venues sounds like it would go with something like that? Does that Irish place on I've been there to hear some Irish singers. So what is it? It's on the main drag there. Tacoma,
in Peekskill?
Yeah. And
The Quiet Man?
Yeah, and the reason I mention it is I think that the layout is awful for straight music because you're in the middle of a very long dining area and most of the action is at the bar. Now, if you had people running around and stashing and stashing instruments and everything, I think that would be perfect there.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. We'll definitely consider that. I mean, I think we're a little heavy, a little loud, and I think for a place like that, we might be a little too much, but
okay.
I can see what you're saying for sure. The great thing about the Guitar Shop, I don't know if you've ever seen music there, is that it's usually $5. It's all ages. It's BYOB, and it's just kind of like an open room with a stage in the back, and the sound guy is fantastic.
Okay.
So it's just like this. It's this great scene that people come and they hang out, and every time people that I know come there either for the first time or even after several times, they always come up to me and just say, I love this place. I love the like vibe here. It's just sort of like a hangout. And I like that it's not a bar. It's just sort of a club in a way, but it's just a guitar shop. You know, it's worked out so well for all of our shows. We did a Halloween show there that was all the bands performed as other bands. And just every show that we've done there has been great.
Speaking of music, you have also had your own music radio show, haven't you?
Yeah. I definitely wanted to touch on that, too. It's called Takedown Notice, and I've done, I think, 8 episodes, and it's on an internet radio station called Radio Nope. That's N-O-P-E, R-A-D-I-O, N-O-P-E, RadioNope.com. And they're good friends of mine who started the radio station, and now I'm kind of like their technology person. So we just rebuilt the website, but with my change in jobs and rebuilding the website, I actually haven't done a radio show in a couple of months. But I'm looking to do them again. So the format is I mean, I have very eclectic taste, but it's, you know, there's punk rock in there, but there's also like, you know, garage rock and kind of, I think I've tended over the 8 shows to play some like kind of outsider music as well, like the Shags and Wesley Willis I'm trying to think of a particular one. Elastic Rubber Band, is that what they're called? Now their name's escaping me. But anyway, a variety of kind of outsider bands trying to expose the audience to these sort of weirdo music. And some of it's not necessarily weird, but it may be more underground and a little less known. And I think maybe the little bit of the hook of the show has been that I record, it's all, none of it is done live. I do it all pre-recorded, and I do my in-between bits while walking around Manhattan. So there's a lot of street noise, and it's sort of a little bit of, you know, I don't write out like what I'm going to say. I just kind of think about the band and talk about some experiences that I've had and what I know about the groups. And I played a lot of my friends' bands on there as well. And so it's called Takedown Notice. I think the website is takedownnotice.com, but the radio site is radionope.com. And there are a number of other really great radio shows on there. In fact, one of them was recently featured in the New York Times as well. So it's really fun.
Now is the whole station a music station, or do they have other things on there?
It's music and talk, and I think it's maybe half and half in terms of live broadcasting and like pre-produced shows. And all of them are available as podcasts as well. So if you go to the website, you'll be able to click through to all the different shows and either podcast them or tune in live. And some of them are a mix of like playing music, but also having the bands come in and do interviews and things like that. So it's really a great mix.
Okay. What else do you have for me?
I guess another thing that I will mention is that I run a website called Peekskill Rocks, and it's basically born out of living in Peekskill and finding out about things typically right after they happen, and thinking, why isn't there like a website or some way to know about all of the amazing things that are happening in Peekskill? And of course, being a web engineer, I was like, oh, I guess it's my job to build this website. So I started it a couple years ago with a friend she's since moved back to Manhattan, and so I've recruited a couple other Peekskill folks to join me in this effort. And it's a little we're not doing as much as I would like to be doing, because all three of us have full-time day jobs. So primarily what we have right now with Peekskill Rocks is every weekend, I say every, although this weekend was so crazy for me and for everyone else that I think we missed this weekend, but every weekend we do a roundup of all of the things that are going on in Peekskill that weekend, from Thursday to Sunday. And every week we have like 20 things to list out. And, you know, we try to have fun with it too. We're kind of little quips to start it off and you know, a little bit of humor in there. So that's been like kind of the core function right now, is to just get out the weekend events. But we also have a calendar built in that has, it's a Google calendar, so you can add it to your phone or your devices, that has like the different city services. If you're on the west side or the east side and you want to know when the yard waste pickup is, or things like that. And we have some other listings for like taxi companies and restaurants, and we would like to work more on that to make sure everything's up to date. We'd also like to do like some community spotlights and profiles, whether it's businesses or people or even like historical things or places of interest. We definitely have a lot of ideas that we want to do more with the website. But the three of us all have full-time jobs, so it's been a challenge. I've reached out to some local community organizations, including the community college here, to try and find some interns. But nothing has panned out yet. But if anyone is interested in helping us do more with the website, this is very much a labor of love, a passion project that we do as volunteers, but just to support the community and because we love Peekskill. So if anybody wants to help us with that, we would definitely take them up on that.
Now it's Peekskill, ROTKS.com.
It is, but the canonical domain is peekskill.rocks. But if you go to peekskillrocks.com, it redirects you to peekskill.rocks.
Okay.
It's .rocks is a new TLD, a new top-level domain that I have really taken a liking to. So the mustard tiger.rocks and peekskill.rocks.
So It's R-O-C-S again? Pig's Guild?
R-O-C-K-S.
R-O-C-K-S. Okay.
Yep. Yep.
Okay. Okay. What else? This is all good stuff. What else you have?
That may be all of it. I'm sure I'll think of something as soon as we wrap things up, but I think that that's all of it for me.
Okay. Well, thank you, Joe. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, John. Thank you for inviting me, and I've had a really good time talking with you. I appreciate it.
A bit of commercial information. My column now appears biweekly in Westchester Guardian, along with regular columns by Congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, and for John Simon. The Westchester Guardian is available in print format and online at www.westchesterguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at medium.com and blogger.com. Send any comments or questions to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And once again, my daily newspaper is free, and it's only one email per day. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in a book. And we'll be back again next week, and I hope you'll join me then. Until then, I think just say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Whoa, Silver. Whoa, Silver. Whoa, whoa. Thanks again, John.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, and I had a lot of fun. Thank you, John.
And good night, everybody.